Okay, well, let's just jump right in and talk about the Tchaikovsky. You've already performed The Little Russian, and I believe 4, and I know 5, and now we're looking at number 6.
Yeah, it's the Great Pathétique Symphony of Tchaikovsky. And as we've talked about before, George, I think Tchaikovsky wrote his music on his sleeve. And if you look at symphonies from 1 to 6, of course, 7 was not completed, but 6 being his final symphony, I think they play out to me like his autobiography. It's really an amazing symphony. And the point is that this is the only symphony Tchaikovsky wrote that ends in a minor key. Now, it's interesting that he premiered this piece himself, conducting number 6, and I think it was in 1893, in October, and he passed away 9 days later.
Right.
The second performance that it received was in November, and it was played as his memorial service. And as we know, with his troubled life inside, he was constantly struggling. We see him struggling as a man. We see him struggling in society, but we see him struggling as a composer. We talk about rewriting. You know, Beethoven was always scratching out themes in his sketchbook. We can see his autographed scores. They're almost illegible because of the scribbling and the crossing out of major sections, not only thematic material, but entire forms, and then rewriting and rewriting and rewriting till he had it exactly where he wanted it, improving his music. Stravinsky was the same way, constantly listening and correcting and changing things to hopefully improve the music to say what he wanted it to say. That wasn't the case with Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky, because of his insecurity, would write a piece of music, and he's written so many beautiful things. I mean, everything from his ballet music to his operas to the symphonies. Lyricism at its best. Really amazing, amazing music. Yet when he was rewriting it, he was often damaging his own music. There's a story once that his brother himself had to hide some scores from Tchaikovsky because for fear that he was going to destroy what he felt was his masterpieces.
Wow, I had not heard that little tidbit.
And it's because of his insecurity. He never felt he was quite good enough or was quite right or never could quite fit in. And this piece of music ends with this beautiful color between the bassoons, the cellos, and finally just the cellos, and then ultimately with the contrabasses fading away to piano, pianissimo, and pianissimo to fading to nothing.
Yeah.
Much like the end of his life.
And the mood of those third and fourth movements reversed. You know, you have triumph in movement 3 and despair in movement 4.
Exactly right.
It's not a happy ending.
It is not a happy ending. And again, he begins it in B minor and ends it in B minor, which is a little peculiar. And it's the only symphony he decided to end in a minor key.
Mm-hmm. It's what I love about the introduction to the third movement. You know, it becomes that fantastic march, but he just draws out the intro with even 2 themes and then slowly builds it up. And then here comes this up-tempo march in tempo. I was playing that back in my head on the way in this morning and remarking on that.
Yeah, it's a really remarkable section of the composition itself. And then you said it, it is so triumphant and ends gloriously and often achieves applause in a performance.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And yet the last movement, when it fades away to nothing, you can hold the silence in a concert hall, which makes it so dramatic. And I think these are very powerful differences between 3 and 4. Yet the second movement is this 5-4 swing, which is a beautiful, lilting little dance. It's a little bit of an unevenness to it, but yet it has a flowing, beautiful, tender melodic value.
Has kind of that ballet feel to it, just like the third movement always did to me in the 5th symphony. You sort of see glimpses of his ballet music in that. At least I have.
Absolutely. It has some really beautiful, a beautiful gait to it. Therefore, his music is very danceable.
Yeah.
And this is one of those occasions. Yet, it's not an even swing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a 2 and a 3, which is a little bit of that lilting waltz feel maybe, but it's a little odd.
Yeah, it's common to, say, jazzers and jam band people these days. They don't think anything about 5, but in, you know, 1898 or whatever it was, that was not common stuff.
That's correct. It's pretty progressive. Yet beautiful, sensitive, moving, but doesn't quite fit in, which again pushes back to the idea of his struggle and maybe awkwardness in society or as a person.
Let's move on to the Samuel Barber. How would you describe Barber to a more unfamiliar listener? I mean, a lot of people know the Adagio for strings, and that's about it.
I think, unfortunately, that's where it stops, unfortunately. The Adagio for strings is a beautiful piece of music that gets played over and over again, and it's one of those things that radio stations play, like Vivaldi's Four Seasons, you know, on Beethoven's Fifth. It's one of the top pieces because everyone identifies with it. It's beautiful, and it's easy to digest. I think Barber was living in that very progressive tonal period of American music. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, along with, say, Hanson.
I think Howard Hanson, in that whole group of people, right in that period where, you know, in the 1900s, we're just pushing the envelope, you know, just before John Cage stopped everything with Silence.
Yeah.
It was people like Barber pushing the ear, pushing the harmonies, pushing the rhythms. And this is a fantastic piece of music because what these composers were doing were changing the form of music, and they did it so well that they changed it and challenged orchestras. You know, composition actually has helped to improve the quality of musicianship because now they're asking players to do technical things that were unheard of and to hear things differently and to push the technical aspect of a player, which improved the quality of the overall orchestra to be able to play repertoire of this nature.
Which makes me think of Barber's Violin Concerto that you all recently did. And
right,
wasn't that last movement was at the time considered unplayable?
It was very unplayable at the time because, and we're talking about great violinists were saying this is unplayable. And fortunately, we were lucky to be able to do it with the great Glenn Dichterow, who was concertmaster for the New York Philharmonic, who absolutely made this sound like it was just another walk in the park. I mean, this facility is so smooth and beautiful. It was a wonderful performance and fun to do, but it's so fast that it's an amazing challenge for the orchestra just to keep up and play it together. But Barber, this symphony here is a symphony. He thinks it himself to be a classical style symphony with four sections.
Yeah.
Although he writes it first symphony in one movement because the way he threads it together, it's not like stop, cough, clap, stop, cough, you know, the whole thing. It's like it weaves itself together into one beautiful movement, but it's distinctly four separate sections. So he was trying to follow the classical style in form, yet he weaved it together to be one movement, and he specifically wrote that in the score, symphony, first symphony in one movement.
And that piece came along just about the right time. He had just won the American Prix de Rome, which gave him the chance to go to Italy and study, and there he became the classmate of Giancarlo Menotti.
And that's where that's correct. In 1936, I think it was performed in Rome. It was performed a year later here in its American debut, 1937, with the Cleveland Orchestra. So this was a very prime time. Now you think about what was happening in that period of time, 1936, 1940s.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting time for the U.S. It's when, you know, things were building, things were developing, things were recovering. And I think music and art sometimes parallels that or reflects that or maybe even driving it at some time, but it's certainly part of that period of life when things were pushing now. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is a bit challenging for the listener. Although it's a classical style form, it's pushing the envelope in many, many ways, but yet it has a section that I find to be one of the most beautiful things of all of his writing, and it happens to be the Andante Tranquillo, where he gives the oboe this beautiful solo. You know what I'm talking about in that third movement?
Yeah.
It's just absolutely beautiful with the muted strings underneath it, this lush, just wonderful, mystical-sounding piece of music that develops it. When I listen to it again, I forget that it's Samuel Barber. It could be written by anyone of beauty and love. It's just so gorgeous, and it's so today. It doesn't sound like 1930s to me. It sounds like it could have been written today. It's very beautiful, and I think that of a lot of great compositions. Good music is timeless. Good art is timeless. And this is one of those examples.
Okay, that's the symphony in one movement. We're going now to a cello concerto in one movement.
Right. This will feature our young artist winner this season to perform with the Paducah Symphony Orchestra. And this is a first because we've had it for the high school level for several years, and that really is rewarding. Its impetus is to inspire and to nurture, hopefully or potentially, young high school students to go into music or go into this field and pursue it. This is the first collegiate winner for the first time that we've added, and therefore this winner will have an opportunity to perform live with the symphony, and that's very exciting on the Carson Center stage. This is a student at the Cleveland Institute of Music. His name is Skinner, and comes actually from a very musical family from Western Kentucky, just coincidentally. So I'm very excited to bring this young man home, to say, and to put him with our orchestra. Now, the chansons, coincidentally enough, is a concerto for violoncello, and by Rachmaninoff and Shostakovich, in their words, both agreed that this was the greatest cello concerto ever written. Now, again, here's the cello concerto, and just happened to work out this way, in three sections, but is played as one piece, one movement as well. So we have the Barber, the symphony form, classical style symphony form, in its four movements, played as one movement, and the chansons is the same situation. In its three movements, just weaved together, played all together as one.
And unlike so many concerti, the soloist begins right off the bat.
I mean, they get one chord from the orchestra, boom, and then they're off to the races. And it's not any time to get in the mood. I mean, there's a half a second to get in the mood and just start playing. And that's it. It's a hammer blow, and we're off to the races. And it's a very difficult concerto.
A little aside here, when I was a kid, they used to have kiddie classical music records at the local library. Milton Cross, the guy who was the announcer for the Met for so many years, did one, and he had each instrument play a solo lick from the repertoire, and that opening line was what he used on that. So I've known that line since I was, 6 years old, but it was many years later before I learned where it came from, and I hear that, and I say, oh, man, I know that.
That's right.
Milton Cross.
Well, those series are great because you learn music, classical music at 6 years old. You just had to put the name to the picture later, you know, to the sound.
Yeah, we had 10-inch LPs, and I'd sit on the floor cross-legged, and before I could read, I could dig through the pile of records and find the one I wanted to play. And my mother never knew why, and I told her years later, well, you know, the Beethoven 7th has the bands are divided up like this, and the Bach Toccata and Fugue has a big scratch on the label and stuff like that.
Right, right, right. So this concerto takes place, you know, 1872, of course, French music with Saint-Saëns. And then, you know, Tchaikovsky brings us to Russia, 1893, different time, but totally different sound, different culture. And we come to the United States with Barber around 1936. So that's where we're jumping around with what's happening in the world at the time, what were people hearing, how do these composers change the world forever? And I think this is just a powerful performance.